Court will proceed to the third case of the day, the United States versus Farishak. Mr. Maher?
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. For the record, my name is James Maher. That's M-A-H-E-R. Good morning. I was the trial attorney for the citizen, Osip Farishak. Your Honors, the court's judgment on count three of the complaint must be reversed. That's our position. There was no evidence that any questions were asked of Mr. Farishak, and there was no evidence that any answers were false. A weaker case of misrepresentation would be difficult to find. There was no evidence that Mr. Farishak falsely told immigration officials anything. This should convince Your Honors that the trial judge did not read the deposition transcripts of either Mr. Koh or Mr. DiCapua, who were the only witnesses presented on the issue of misrepresentation. The defense in the case did not concede that if you find that Mr. Farishak served in the UAP, that you must then find that he misrepresented facts in the visa application process. We at all times denied that Mr. Farishak was involved in the UAP and that he misrepresented any material facts in obtaining his citizenship. The government argued that...
Well, I just want to understand. I thought your position was that there's no doubt, no dispute about the Ukrainian auxiliary police being sort of an arm of the Nazis, and if you were a member of that, you obviously participated in, either personally or as a member of the group, with persecution. But the government failed to prove that your client was, in fact, in that group.
I agree, Your Honor.
I thought that was your position here, and not that there was no misrepresentation. He just wasn't involved.
That's
your position.
That's generally correct, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Right. Not correct.
Also, the government contends in its brief that we stipulated that all UAP policemen performed duties that were persecutory, and that all UAP personnel contributed to Nazi persecution of the Jews. And we've argued in our brief that wasn't proven, that all members of an organization don't necessarily participate in persecutory...
Yeah, but that's arguing off the other side here. Your position is he wasn't in this group.
That's right.
So you're not going to argue that, well, but if he was, he wasn't one of the bad guys in the group. You're not going to make that argument, are you?
Well, I'm going to make the argument, Your Honor, that the evidence also doesn't support any evidence that he personally participated in any specific act of misconduct or persecution. And I respectfully disagree with the government's position on that mere membership alone is sufficient to denaturalize a U.S. citizen. Judges, as the case law shows, the government has to show that there were willful misrepresentations. Omissions of fact are not sufficient. The case of U.S. versus Sokolov spoke directly to that issue, and its relevance to this case was definitely not elusive. A close reading of that case shows that the government tried to use that exact same strategy in that case that they did in this case. They asked a Department of State employee general questions about questions that may or may not have been asked, and that is not sufficient to prove that questions were asked and that misrepresentations were given. As I said, there was absolutely no evidence that Mr. Farishak made any false representations to anyone in obtaining his citizenship. The count three is certainly should be reversed. He was asked, Mr. Koh was asked at his...
His representation was, as I understand, Mr. Maher, he was a laborer for the December 41 to April 44 period.
I think that alleged representation only appeared in the actual report that was prepared by the Displaced Persons Commission, which was not signed by Mr. Farishak, nor was there any testimony that he was ever, this Mr. Sutter, who was actually doing the investigating apparently, was ever presented. If Your Honors will compare the report of the commission to the actual visa application itself, there's nothing in the actual visa application itself that asks anything about employment or wartime activities, only residences. And I would submit that if you look carefully at that visa application, there was nothing false that was proven by the government about his residences.
Well, if one were a member of UAP for 20 months and were a laborer for two during that period and represented to, at the time of speaking with the immigration officials, said only I was a laborer during that period, didn't say 2 months, didn't say 22 months, and just never mentioned UAP. I'm giving you a hypothetical.
Okay.
I'm not asking you to acknowledge anything in this case. Would that be a misrepresentation as to work during that period?
No, because under the scenario you just gave, the question wasn't asked. That was an. I think, Your Honor.
The position is there was no direct inquiry of whether there was membership in the UAP.
That's right. That's right. And that would be required to denaturalize someone under Section 2, I'm sorry, 10 of the DPA. Mr. Cote testified as follows at his deposition, Your Honors. Do you have any personal recollection at all of anyone named Osip Firishek? Answer, no. Question, do you have any personal recollection of ever asking him any questions with regard to his admission to the country? Answer, no.
But the records of the Ukrainian police had his name, his town of birth, and his date of birth. It's a lot of coincidences.
I would submit that that were true if the government had met its burden of showing that the documents themselves are in fact authentic. And as I've argued, I hope, extensively in my briefs, I don't think they prove that. The expert witness who testified was never even asked, do you have an opinion as to what these documents are? And if so, what is it? And it seems to me if you're going to denaturalize a U.S. citizen based only on documents, you have to prove convincingly that those documents are what they purport to be. And that didn't happen at this trial. If you look at the transcripts, Your Honor, there was never a testimony elicited from this expert that convincingly proves that what these documents are.
What do you think they are?
Well, I think that the government failed to prove what they are. I think that they're documents that the government failed to prove to the judge were authentic. And I think that if you want the inference that Mr. Firishek was in fact a member of this organization, it's incumbent on the government to prove that the documents are authentic in the first place, and therefore leading to the inference that he is in fact a member.
So unless they had somebody from the Ukrainian police who would come in and testify, these are my documents, I created them, any evidence short of that would mean the government couldn't prove this?
Well, I think that would be helpful, but I agree with Your Honor that that wouldn't necessarily be sufficient if, in fact, you had an expert who could elicit enough testimony from that the documents are, in fact, authentic. Why, doctor, do you think they're authentic? Why are you so convinced that they're authentic? What was it about these documents that is so convincingly proven that these are business records of the UAP? And I agree.
Well, he admitted them as ancient documents, didn't he? They admitted as ancient. And isn't the admission of this pretty much the district judge's call? It's a bench trial. He's going to make a finding, and we have to review that only for clear error, I would assume.
Right. I incline to agree with Your Honor on that as well, but the weight that's to be given to the exhibits is something that has to be evaluated de novo by Your Honors. Was the judge's legal conclusion that these documents are in fact convincingly authentic, proven by clear and convincing evidence? And I agree that getting the documents into evidence in the first place is one thing, but proving the hearsay facts that are included in the documents and therefore the inference that this man was a member of this organization has to be proven by more than just the fact that a 20-year-old date appears on the document.
What of Mr. Maher, Dr. Pohl's testimony?
What about it?
Yeah, I mean, as to supporting the authentication of the documentation.
The government did not elicit detailed testimony from him as to what they are, why they're authentic. It was just, do you have any reason to question the authenticity of the document, doctor? And then we moved on in shotgun fashion, document after document after document.
But there was no objection, as I understand it, Mr. Maher, to the qualifications of Dr. Pohl.
That's correct, Your Honors. I didn't necessarily dispute his qualifications as an expert. However, I think as the defense attorney, I reserve the right, and did, to argue that his testimony is still not clear and convincingly effective enough to establish that they are, in fact, Ukrainian auxiliary police records. After all, we have a man who was born in 1962, who basically has studied this only for a limited period of time. These are documents that were prepared, presumably in the course of a business 50 or 60 years earlier.
Well, you wouldn't preclude somebody alive today from being qualified to talk of a 19th century document, would you?
No.
As a hypothetical.
No, but if I'm the trial lawyer...
You would have to be living contemporaneously with the creation date, I wouldn't think, would you?
I agree, Your Honor, but if I'm the trial lawyer, I'm asking that witness detailed questions as to why these documents are authentic. Where did you see them? Why is it likely that they're in a museum in Lviv or in the U.S. Memorial War Museum 50 years later? I mean, there's a 50-year gap. We have to establish by clear and convincing evidence that the documents are what the government purports them to be. And I would think that the witness has to convincingly show that, especially when we've got citizenship involved. The gentleman's been here for 50 years and has not committed even, as far as I know, a parking ticket. We feel that the government didn't meet its burden of proof in the first instance. Therefore, it was not incumbent on Mr. Fearshack to prove that his signature wasn't on the documents. And I'll reserve my
bottle
of wine. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mencken.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, Jeffrey L. Mencken, United States Department of Justice, for the appellee. Your Honor, we've submitted a very detailed brief on this and fully prepared to rely upon that with a few comments. And, of course, I would be happy to answer any questions the Court may have. But the dispositive issue is whether Mr. Fearshack was in the Ukrainian Auxiliary Police, which was a Nazi-sponsored organization which took part in the persecution and ultimate massacre of close to 100,000 people, 100,000 Jewish people, in the city of Lviv during World War II. Mr. Fearshack's name appears on 21 wartime documents, as many, if not more, than any other Nazi case ever brought to court. His signature appears on 7 of those. He identified his signature on 7 of those documents. The rest of these little objections just do not simply hold water. I would point out that the vice counsel who processed Mr. Fearshack's application testified, as other court decisions state, that vice counsels were required to and, in fact, did rely upon the reports of the Displaced Persons Commission. It is stipulated that Mr. Fearshack's Displaced Persons report says that he was a laborer at a cooperative in Lviv from 1941 to 1944. The vice counsel said that he relied on that report, and given that report, he would have asked, as he did in every single case where he processed an application, what did you do during the war? And Mr. Fearshack could not have told him the truth being that he served in the Ukrainian police almost from its creation in October 1941 until shortly before the Nazis ran away from Lviv in July of 1944. That fact-finding is dispositive of each of the independent four counts on which judgment was granted. The idea
your position is that mere membership in this Ukrainian auxiliary police disqualifies you.
Well, it absolutely is, Your Honor. Under count two, membership is disqualifying. As far as the assistance and persecution count, it's really threefold. This court found in the Cherinskis case that membership, or rather participation in an entity that is dedicated to the extermination of people is in itself assistance and persecution. So there is a membership aspect to the assistance and persecution charge. The evidence proved and the judge found that all members of the Ukrainian police took part in these massive, massive actions to murder people. There was one in March, one June, several in August of 1942. Thousands of Jews were collected from the ghetto and taken out. The Ukrainian police did not have sufficient manpower to give someone the day off when 300 people are being taken away on one morning, 500 people another morning, totaling in the tens of thousands. So by performing the routine and daily duties of a Ukrainian policeman, Mr. Firshak assisted in persecution. Thirdly, Mr. Firshak was shown to have taken part in a search for other policemen who didn't show up for duty during this ghetto clearance action. And several of the people that he was sent out to find and bring in were shown to have taken part thereafter. So he's in it multiple ways. As far as Dr. Pohl never saying that these were Ukrainian police documents, that's nonsense. He was the expert on these documents. He was qualified as an expert on these documents without objection. He was asked questions to authenticate these documents without objection. And there was we make what I think is a compelling argument that this entire point is waived. You can't allow someone who you say isn't qualified to authenticate documents, to authenticate wartime documents, including documents of the Ukrainian police, and then turn around when it gets to be a damaging document and say, wait a second, we are surprised. We did not know that you would be authenticating these. That is a classic waiver situation. Never addressed by the defense is the point that we bring out in our brief, that if you take out the ancient document exception here, which is followed letter by letter, these documents were certified and therefore were self-authenticating, and so we don't need a witness to bring them in. So any way you slice this, Mr. Firshak comes up short.
Who certifies them?
They were certified by the archives of the State Archive in Ukraine, in Lviv. They also were certified by the United States Embassy in Kiev, Ukraine. There's no challenge to either of those. That they are certified foreign public documents, and their certifications were never challenged. Those are self-authenticating, and they include the naming documents, including the seven documents Mr. Firshak acknowledged he signed. What more do I need to do? The defendant acknowledged that he signed these documents. They have his date of birth, his city of birth, his father's name. He acknowledged that there are no other people born with his name on his date in his town to his parents. Short of some evil twin hypothetical, Mr. Firshak is in a box, and it's not the fault of the United States that he presented a bogus alibi, which was rejected by the district court.
How soon post 1989 were these documents made available to the government, to our government?
I believe, generally speaking, Your Honor, Dr. Pohl testified that they were available to Western researchers around 1993-4. They were not previously before that. Dr. Pohl actually reviewed the collection of these materials in Lviv and is the expert on this subject matter. Unless the court has any other questions, we're prepared to rely on our briefs. I would ask that each of the four independent counts on which judgment was granted be upheld.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Maher.
Your Honors, the vice counsel in this case was a man named Everett Coe, and he did not testify at trial that any questions were ever asked. Count three must be reversed. Being qualified as an expert doesn't waive the rules of evidence, and I did not waive the rules of evidence because I did not object to every single document. As a defense attorney, it's a good strategy sometimes to only object to the documents that incriminate your client, which is what I did. That was a reasonable strategy, and I certainly did not waive anything. Certifications that are done by people who work at a museum 50 years later does not prove the facts contained within the documents. These documents were prepared 50 years earlier. Obviously, people at the museum in Lviv do not have personal knowledge of any of these documents. Accordingly, it's incumbent on the government to introduce testimony from their expert that these are, in fact, authentic, and nothing like that happened at this trial. Also, if you look closely at the expert witness report, that opinion is not disclosed. The cases are clear on this. Anything you want an expert to testify to at trial must be contained in his report. Exhibit 152 was his report, and there's not a single line in there that any of these documents are, in fact, genuinely kept records of the UAP in the regular course of business. That's the inference that the government needs to link this defendant to this activity. If you're going to denaturalize someone and take his citizenship away based on documents, you have to authenticate the documents. You have to introduce clear and convincing evidence that they are what the government purports them to be. We can't just assume that that's what they are, as the trial judge and the government has done in this case.
Mr. Maher, what of the weight should be given to the acknowledgement of the signature?
Judge, the signatures that were the question that was asked of Mr. Firoshek was not, is this your signature? It was, do these appear to be your signature? And accordingly, and also the questioning was by Mr. Drimmer and not Mr. Groner. Apparently, Mr. Groner's role was to assess the, you know, the mannerisms of Mr. Firoshek, and that's how he testified at court, as if he was observing this man testifying and rendering an opinion as to his truthfulness. I agree, Your Honor, that the signatures are the signatures, but I don't think that under the applicable burden of proof that would be clear and convincing. I don't think that his testimony was unequivocal that they are his signature, and accordingly I wouldn't think it meets the burden of proof. Fedorenko versus United States, the footnote 34 has been the law for many, many years now, Your Honors. I don't think it disappears. I don't respectfully disagree with the government that mere membership alone is sufficient. I've cited some cases that disagree with that proposition. I would ask the court to look carefully at Ozadach and Fedorenko. Those cases do not say that mere membership alone is sufficient. There are other cases that the court did not, wasn't inclined to follow that I cited. Sprogus and Lilakis are cases that say that there must be some type of personal involvement to show persecutory conduct by the individual in order to exact this serious remedy. I also argued, Your Honors, that the trial judge was a little bit unfair to me during the trial, and I stick by my position there. The court repeatedly assisted the government in introducing documents into evidence, which never would have been gotten in. I have, like, 10 exhibits, 12, 25, 12, 15, 16, 19, 160, 26, 34, 54, 61, 87, and 89. All of those would never have been introduced into evidence if the trial judge didn't assist the government.
How did the trial judge do that?
We would be moving on to another exhibit, and trial counsel would ask additional questions about an additional exhibit, and he was about to move that second exhibit into evidence when the judge would say, well, are you done with the previous exhibit, which was the cue for the government to move to admit the very previous exhibit.
You would say a trial judge asking whether you wish to admit it is an unfair advantage?
I would say that it's participating in the trial. There were a couple other examples where he was interrupting the cross-examination of the key witness repeatedly and stopping my train of thought. And all I asked was that the judge, I don't begrudge the trial judge's right to disagree with me. And what I begrudged was I thought that the partisan conduct in the trial and helping the government along the way, and then when it's my turn to cross-examine this man, interrupting the flow of the testimony. This is the key witness who I'm going to try to prove on cross-examination doesn't have personal knowledge of any of these, which I think I did. There was no
interrupting by inserting his own question, you mean?
Right.
Is that the kind of interruption?
Yes. And other types of anecdotes and try to, I think he helped the witness in a lot of cases too, Your Honors, by saying, well, that's not exactly what the witness said, which gave the cue, of course, for the witness to change his answer to a previously given question. That happened numerous times in the transcript. And as I said, I don't begrudge the judge's right to disagree with me, but on the other hand, I asked for a continuance 2 weeks before the trial was denied. And I had to do I didn't go out of state, but these depositions of these gentlemen, Coe and DeCapo, were taken 2 weeks before the trial. And on my motion to continue, I was asked to present, well, why are you prejudiced? And my position was, Judge, they have to show why discovery should be reopened 2 weeks before the trial, so I now have to do evidence depositions, which the government calls them de bene esse depositions. That was discovery, and I was not able to prepare for trial. So, Your Honors, I would ask you to look at Fedorenko. I would ask you to look at Ozadach, Lilakis, Sprogus, and even Sirinskis that the government cites. I don't think any of those cases involve just documents that were used to denaturalize someone. They all involved more evidence, and accordingly, because the government did not meet its burden, I would ask respectfully that all four counts of the complaint be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Maher. Thank you, Mr. Mankin.
Thank you, judges.
Case is taken under advisement.